and ended the war with 400 ships. And they ranged from everything from high-speed motor launches to minesweepers, corvettes, frigates, destroyers. We had two cruisers in commission at the end of the war.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Welcome back to another episode. Roger Littwiller is a Canadian author, historian, and lecturer. He has written the books White Ensign Flying, Warships of the Bay of Quinte, as well as articles for magazines and newspapers. Roger has lectured across Canada, including the Crow's Nest in St. John's and the Military Museums of Calgary. Imparting the incredible stories of the Canadian Navy, Roger was a naval officer in the Canadian Armed Forces Reserve. His interest in the Royal Canadian Navy began as a sea cadet in Kitchener. Roger, welcome to Preble Hall.
Good morning, Claude. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to speak to our partners and allies to the north. We've done a couple of episodes, and this really gives us an opportunity to showcase the contributions and sacrifices of one of our partnered nations. And I know we're going to be releasing this on Remembrance Day, and I was wondering if you could tell us, because a lot of our listeners are Americans, may be familiar with Veterans Day, but they're not as familiar with Remembrance Day. So could you please tell us a little bit about that?
Well, absolutely. It all began after the First World War and the ending of the First World War on November 11th. And Canada and many other countries have taken that day to honor the sacrifice of our military in war. So part of that is a huge symbol for remembrance in Canada and other parts of the world, and that is the poppy, the red flower that you will see many Canadians and Europeans wear. And that stems from a poem written by a Canadian Army surgeon, John McCrae. He wrote it in World War I during one of the battles, and he had just lost a dear friend. And so between surgeries, he wrote a very simple poem in Flanders Fields. And that was later published in a UK newspaper where it was kind of lost. And it was later again published in the UK and in Canada. And from there, the poppy has become the symbol of remembrance, to be worn, you know, for 2 weeks prior to Remembrance Day.
Well, I remember that poem, not as a poem specifically, but it was made into song by the post-World War II composer and singer Jacques Brel, a Belgian composer.
Yeah.
And he sang it in both French and Flemish.
Yes. And
just really a beautiful song, but also a beautiful poem that that honors the sacrifice of those soldiers. So thanks for giving us the update. We're going to be talking about the Canadian Navy during World War II, and specifically about the ships of the Canadian Navy. And I want to talk first about the Flower Class corvettes. Tell us about what this magnificent class did during World War II. What was its mission?
Well, they truly were the workhorse of the Navy, and not just Canada's, but others as well. They at the beginning of the war, there was a severe shortage of escort ships all the way around. England lacked escorts, Canada lacked escorts. So the Royal Navy started looking for something literally cheap, dirty, and nasty, and could be quickly built. So they eventually settled on a Norwegian whale ship design, and mainly because the hull design had excellent seakeeping responsibilities. It could stay afloat in just about anything and plow through the worst of weather. So it was rapidly converted to carry weapons and a crew, and initially designed for a crew of 50. And, you know, small gun forward, 4-inch with, a 2-pounder aft and depth charges and, you know, very limited weapons. But again, it was an escort, so they were looking to fight submarines, right? Another advantage was the turning radius. It could actually outturn a submerged submarine and get within its turning radius, giving it an advantage in the attack. So the designs were made, they were handed out, copy of the designs were sent to Canada to be built, and construction began in shipyards right across the country. East Coast, West Coast, on the Great Lakes, in the St. Lawrence River, and Canada started building these ships en masse.
How many did you build?
I believe, I think the number was about 120 approximately. I don't have the exact figure with me at the moment. But the ships were so well designed for the job that they were doing, they quickly went into use throughout the Allied navies. France built a few before she surrendered. They were used in the Royal Navy, the Royal Norwegian Navy, the Polish Navy, South African Navy, and the Canadian Navy, of course. And it's the largest class of warships that has ever been built. With the UK built ships, the total is well over 200. And it's the only class of ships that was actually used by both Allied and Axis, because the French ships at the surrender were taken up in the German Navy.
Were those part of the Vichy French Navy forces?
I believe they went directly to Germany on surrender of the on the surrender of France.
Now for the Canadian, go ahead, please.
The Free French forces did take up some of the Royal Navy corvettes that were loaned to.
And these were used primarily in the Battle of the Atlantic?
Yes, they were designed primarily as a coastal escort, a little bit of a jack of all trade. The initial corvettes were built with full minesweeping capabilities as well. And none of the Canadian corvettes were ever used for minesweeping. They all primarily went right to ocean escort. And eventually, with modifications and addition of weapon systems, the crew space that was designed for approximately 50 ended up being used by up to 100 sailors at any given time. So they were cramped, they were crowded, they were wet. Many described it could roll on grass with dew, right? And but ultimately, they were responsible for escorting the vast majority of the convoys across the Atlantic.
Do you get a sense of how many were lost during the war?
I believe all total from all nations, I think it was 47.
And they weren't just operating in terms of the Canadian Navy. Your primary mission was for the Battle of the Atlantic. But as I was looking this up, I noticed that there were some Canadian corvettes, the Flower Class corvettes, that were lost in Sri Lanka, Madagascar. I was wondering if you might know some of the circumstances that would have led to Canadian Navy ships being in those regions as well.
Well, part of the escort operations of the RCN during the war was not just going from Canada's eastern seaboard to the UK. Our ships were also escorting convoys out of the Caribbean, Guantanamo, Aruba, Trinidad, and then during specific operations, they were escorting convoys through the Mediterranean, some ships going as far as Egypt during Operation Torch campaign, southern France during the invasion of our operations in the invasion of southern France as well, and also into the St. Lawrence. And when the U-boats moved their campaign into the St. Lawrence River in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And three of our corvettes were also involved in the Aleutian campaign on the Pacific coast.
I don't think people realize that how far the German U-boats advanced. I know there was some operations in the Chesapeake Bay, but that you don't get a sense of the size of the St. Lawrence until you realize the size of the ships, mm-hmm. merchant ships that are going through there that would have afforded the opportunity for. But it's still amazing that a U-boat would have had any maneuvering space in the St. Lawrence.
Yes, the St. Lawrence is big. It's a huge river. It's also the Gulf of St. Lawrence is vast. And the river itself is taking ocean-going ships of all sizes, all the way into Montreal. The U-boats penetrated almost as far as Quebec City, and sinking from 1942, when the attacks first started in the Gulf and in the river, to the end of the war, 27 ships were lost in the St. Lawrence, and major convoy battles. The RCN ended up running convoys from near Rimouski all the way out to Sydney, Cape Breton in Nova Scotia. And some of these convoys involved 20 merchant ships with destroyers and corvettes and minesweeper escorts. And one convoy in particular came under attack by two U-boats and with heavy loss. And, the St. Lawrence, for as large as it is, there were people watching from shore as these battles were transpiring in front of them.
That's incredible, because I'm trying to remember, when you're standing, say on the terrace right below the Chateau Frontenac in Quebec City, mm-hmm. and you're looking at the St. Lawrence, and even just out of eyesight is up the river is Île d'Orléans, which I just can't imagine being a U-boat commander and trying to navigate that region. Tell us more about the people who were serving on the ships, because with such a small crew, they must have had very junior officers in command, lieutenants or lieutenant commanders.
There was a lot of very junior people in the RCN. At the beginning of the war, the RCN was very small. She had six destroyers, a few minesweepers, and total personnel, regular Navy and reserves, came to about 6,000. By the end of the war, and the RCN, very few people realize, the RCN had the highest rate of growth of any Allied Navy in the war. It grew at a rate of 50-1. So for every one sailor that was employed in 1939, 50 more joined by the end of 1945, men and women.
Sorry about that. I seem to remember a figure that said something like, by the end of the war, that Canada had the fourth largest Navy in the world.
Well, actually, fourth largest merchant Navy and third largest Navy in the world. Second to England and the United States, and ended the war with 400 ships. And they ranged from everything from high-speed motor launches to minesweepers, corvettes, frigates, destroyers. We had two cruisers in commission at the end of the war and two aircraft carriers. One was still in commission at the end of the war, and one had been damaged and taken out of service during the war.
Did Canada construct those carriers from the keel up, or were those purchased from other Allied nations?
Actually, that is a really interesting story. They were built for the U.S. Navy in Tacoma. They were loaned to the Royal Navy, and they were manned by the Royal Canadian Navy. So you want to talk about a true international ship. The two carriers were just that.
What were those two carriers?
The first one was Nabob, and the second one was Puncher. And that was the names given to them by the British.
What happens to the Nabob? There's an interesting story there.
Yes. She was first of the two RCN carriers to come into commission. Built at Tacoma as USS Edisto. And on commissioning, she was renamed to Nabob. Sailed to Vancouver, where she was brought to Royal Navy specifications, which included extending the flight deck by 15 feet, altering the magazines to accept both Royal Navy and USM munitions, better fire or anti-fire operations, like on the hangar, all the electrical systems were moved 8 feet off the deck, different accommodation styles to accommodate a wardroom of officers and a mess for the chiefs and petty officers. And some of the equipment were taken out, and some was left, like the USN is using bunks where the Royal Navy and the Canadian Navy were using hammocks. So fortunately for the men in that ship, the bunks remained. One of the items that did upset the Canadian sailors a little bit was the American ice cream machine was removed.
We call it.
But she was manned by RCN sailors with a Canadian commanding officer by the name of Captain Horatio Nelson Lay. And from Vancouver, she sailed off, gathered her Royal Navy air wing off San Diego of Avengers, sailed through the Panama Canal, and took on a deckload of Mustangs to ferry to the UK out of New York City, and proceeded over to the UK. While there, she participated out of Scapa Flow on operations against the German Navy in Norway. So the first operation was laying a minefield with aircraft in the channels in Norway, forcing the German coastal forces out into the open water. And that was followed shortly thereafter with operations against Tirpitz, which was being hidden in the Ka Ford, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And that was a rather large fleet operation. There was three fleet carriers, two escort carriers, battleship, three cruisers, six destroyers, and five frigates made up that fleet. The intent was to bomb Tirpitz in the fjord where she laid, and at the same time lay mines in the fjord so that she couldn't escape. They wanted to damage and bottle her up. And the first day of the action was successful. The fleet drew further out to sea to spend the night to remount the attack the next day. And Nabob was just getting ready to provide fuel for three frigates when she was suddenly struck by one of four torpedoes fired at her by U-354 and created a 40 by 50 foot hole in her aft starboard side. And that was one torpedo in the side of her hull. Flooding, as you can imagine, was instantaneous. 21 of her crew were killed, another 10 wounded. Yeah, 21 killed, 10 wounded. Immediately, she lost all power. With the loss of power, ventilation went as well. The engine room soared to 150 degrees. You know, the engines were shut down, boilers were shut down. And Nabob, for all intents and purposes, is dead in the water. She developed a 7-degree list to her side, and the stern started to settle, and her freeboard went from a normal draft of 28 feet to a draft of 42 feet. She was literally left with 4 feet of freeboard at her stern. Preparations were made to abandon as the crew was fighting to save their ship. They managed to stop the flooding. They eventually managed to restore power. In that time, the U-boat fired another torpedo, a NAT, with the intention of the coup de grace. Unfortunately, the destroyer HMS Pickerton was in the way of that torpedo, which she took, killing quite a number of her crew and wounding many. And she was eventually put down by one of the other destroyers in the fleet. Some of Nabob's crew was moved off, including the wounded, to another destroyer. Damage control parties continued to work. They managed to get the bulkhead shored up between the flooding and the engine room. And able to get power restored, get the boilers fired, and managed to start making way. very slowly at 2 knots. And she turned south and started the 1,100-mile voyage back to Scapa. And, you know, an incredible feat of seamanship just on that right there. But her story didn't end there. The next day, while proceeding very slowly and with severe damage, her high-frequency direction finder picked up another German U-boat just 3,600 yards off. So Captain Lay launched two of the Avenger aircraft off her slope deck. Pilots were able to keep the submarine submerged for 3.5 hours while NABOB was able to alter course and move out of range of the submarine. And then the two pilots landed back on NABOB. First one made a successful landing. Unfortunately, the second one crashed through the barrier and ended up wrecking two more aircraft and damaging another four. But there were no injuries in the crash. Later on the next day, another high-frequency direction finder bearing was on another U-boat. Fortunately, it was far enough away that just a simple alteration of course gave a safe distance. But the crew remaining on board continued to fight the ship the whole journey back. And with the galleys completely flooded, for the 5-day journey back to Scapa, they primarily lived on short rations and rum. So she made it back to Scapa under her own power on the 27th, and where the ship was declared a total constructive loss. And she spent the rest of the war literally tied up and used as a part ship for other escort carriers. And at the end of the war, she was sold, the flight deck was removed, and she went into merchant service where she continued to operate until 1978. It's an amazing story of bravery, heroism, sacrifice, seamanship. You know, just astounding. You know, she was built for the United States Navy. But the U.S. Navy doesn't lay any claim because she was loaned to the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy doesn't lay any claim because she was manned by Canadians, right? And the Canadian Navy does lay claim to her in the sense that it was Canadians manning her. But because under the Lend-Lease she had to retain the HMS, the Royal Navy HMS, she was never actually commissioned into the Canadian Navy. So her phenomenal story, for the most part, is not very well told.
And there's the story of the HMCS Trentonian.
Trentonian was one of those flower-class corvettes. She was built later in the war, so in her design, there already was several modifications to the corvette. So she was a little drier than most, but still quite crowded. And you know, at 208 feet, she rode many a North Atlantic storm with, you know, as most sailors that have sailed in small ships will tell you, a bit of an uncomfortable ride. She operated convoys on the North Atlantic before she was transferred to the UK for the Normandy invasion. Started the invasion escorting convoys between the UK and the beachhead. And the incident in question started on June 12, 1944, just a few days after the invasion. Trentonian was given the task of escorting a cable laying ship from the UK to the beachhead, and that was Monarch. And cable layers were in very high demand, but also very highly targeted. There was only a few cable layers operational, and they were a prize target of the German submariners, because if they could disrupt communication cables and there were no ships to fix them, you know, communications is key when it comes to operating a military. So Trentonian was a one-to-one escort for the cable layer Monarch. The cable took a long time to lay, as most cable laying does. So Trentonians spent many hours literally steaming circles around this cable layer, doing anti-submarine sweeps in the English Channel. Now, the channel at this time is not a quiet place. There is an awful lot of marine traffic going back and forth between the beachhead and the UK. So there are always ships around. There's always aircraft over top. And during the course of the escort, they did spot a squadron of planes overhead and assumed they were friendly until they started dropping bombs on some landing ships nearby. Fortunately, they all missed, but in very short order, a squadron of Spitfires came in and chased the German aircraft off. Later on in the night, they had a couple of German E-boats pass down the side that didn't engage, fortunately for them.
And the E-boats, for clarification, those are comparable to the U.S. PT boats or Allied PT boats.
That's right. Yeah. At one point, the Aztec operator, which is sonar, right, did hear the sound of a torpedo in the water nearby. So at some point, there may have been a U-boat in the area that fired torpedoes that missed. But again, there's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of stuff going on. Everybody basically had their areas of operation. And part of the operation was a group of American destroyers patrolling off the beachhead for that, enemy submarine and surface forces. You know, in the general orders to the Allies, the location of Trentonian and the cable layer was shown where they would be, but they were under strict radio silence as they were proceeding across the channel. In fact, the only signal they were to acknowledge was by Monarch, and that was a flash of the letter N from the French coast as they approached, so that they knew exactly where to drop the cable when they got to the other side. So as the two ships neared the coast of France, a signal flash was sent by an American destroyer, and Trentonian did not see it, and it may or may not have been seen in Monarch, but again, it was not answered. And so after the U.S. destroyer, and it was USS Plunkett, attempted another recognition signal, which again was not answered, Plunkett opened fire. So the initial attack was on Trentonian. Fortunately for Trentonian, all the ships missed, or all around missed the corvette. But Trentonian skipper does say one did manage to come between the bridge and the funnel, which is only about 20 feet of distance. So the skipper on Trentonian immediately started to signal with the recognition lamps. And at that point, the fire was checked on Trentonian and immediately resumed on Monarch. And over the course of 5 minutes, over 85-inch rounds were expended by Plunkett, and with Monarch taking the brunt of the damage. Skipper of Trentonian was finally able to get the fire stopped by turning on every single light in the corvette and placing his ship between Plunkett and Monarch. And at that time, Plunkett checked her fire. When the dust settled, two sailors had been killed outright in Monarch, and another 24 injured. Cable layer was, her entire upper works were devastated. The bridge was completely gone. The cable that they had almost finished laying was lost to the sea. Monarch was able to make way, but just barely. So, and it's not anybody's fault. There's a lot of things that have to happen for an incident like that to take place. And ultimately, it boils down to communication and what you know and what you don't know. You know, the skipper of Plunkett, yeah, he admitted, yes, I knew they were there, but there was some discussion on open transmission earlier about E-boats in the vicinity, which there were. So when it came to somebody on the open radio had questioned the ships that were on the radio as to who they were and what they were, you know, instead of identifying them what they actually were. So it opened doubts. And in that environment, you can't have doubts. So when recognition was challenged and not acknowledged, that doesn't leave many options, especially when you have a closing range and an operation going around you that will determine the successful or unsuccessful outcome of the war. There was no real investigation, nor was there any punishment on either side. And it was just considered a misfortune of the war and things carrying on.
Let's talk for just a few more minutes about a specific Corvette, Flower-class Corvette, and that's in Halifax. I had a pleasure of visiting that ship probably about 20 years ago now.
Okay.
Is that the only Flower-class Corvette remaining?
That is HMCS Sackville in Halifax is the last Corvette of the over 200 that were built. And she absolutely is a treasure. She was used after she continued in service with the Canadian Navy for several years after the war. She did go to the Canadian Research Establishment and carried out a lot of scientific studies. At the end of her service, a very foresighted group of individuals bought the ship with the intention of turning her into a tribute to the sailors of the Second World War and the many sailors that served in Corvettes. To this day, she is still operational in the sense that she carries on as a museum. As we speak right now, she is in the Navy dockyard in Halifax, inside the repair shops at Fleet Maintenance Facility Cape Spot. Cape Scott out of the water, and sections of her hull are being replaced. And at 75 years old, this is her latest midlife refit.
Once the COVID restrictions are lifted eventually, I hope people will get a chance to see it. It's not only a fantastic city, Halifax, Nova Scotia, but it truly is a unique ship to visit. And I hope our listeners will get an opportunity to see that in the near future. Roger Littwiller, Canadian author, historian, and lecturer. Roger, thanks so much for taking your time today. We think of you, our allies and partners, and we wish you well.
Thank you very much, Claude. It's been a treat to be here.
And for our listeners, thanks for joining us again. And we hope that if you enjoyed this episode, please leave any feedback you have on any of the platforms you're listening to this. And have a great day.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.